Hello, STEM lovers, science dabblers, and everyone who just forgot to turn over after the last show. Welcome to a new episode of Us and STEM with me, Ellie Bladen, on CamFM. Each week, I chat to a new guest scientist, put them under the microscope to dissect their work, investigate their life in science, and examine what makes them tick. Today, we'll be asking, how can being asymmetrical help your hearing if you're very small? How far should we trust the science in Marvel movies? And how can we translate our enthusiasm into effective science communication? This week, we're heading over the pond to speak to our guest. That's metaphorically, of course. CamFM haven't given me a travel budget. So yesterday, I caught up with Max Michelsteitz over Skype to hear about everything from biological modelling to superhero science.
Thank you so much, Max, for coming on the show. This is very exciting because it's my first stateside interview. Could you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Max Michelsteitz. I'm a master's graduate student in the departments of BEAM and mathematics at Virginia Tech in Virginia in the United States.
And you're currently working on a type of fly parasite. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes. Right now, I'm trying to model Ormea ochracea, which is a parasitoid fly that has field crickets as its preferred host. And the reason that we're so interested in it is because Ormea ochracea is about, it fit pretty neatly on the head of an eraser. It's pretty small, or a pencil eraser specifically. And despite that, it's able to locate crickets just as well as we can in terms of its auditory processing capability. And in fact, it locates them just by listening for them. It doesn't really use sight or smell or anything else. And what I'm doing is I'm taking a model that we have for the way it hears, a simplified mathematical model, and I'm trying to improve it, and I'm trying to connect it to some actual photographs that we got of the organ it uses and some 3D modeling that we got of the organ.
That's amazing. So I want to go a little bit more into the ecology because this just sounds absolutely fascinating. So you said that these flies can really precisely locate the crickets. So how far away from them can they actually locate them?
So that would depend a little bit on the cricket and how loudly it was chirping. The lower threshold for the flies to react to the cricket chirping is about 65 decibels. So it's not quiet, but it's also not extremely loud. In terms of distance, basically what the fly does is it just flies around until it finds it hears a cricket well enough. And as far as actually locating it, it can do it to about 2 degrees on the horizontal axis. So there's sort of a 2 degree slice, and it'll know somewhere in that slice there's a cricket.
Wow. Okay. But how is it doing this? Because they're absolutely tiny. I'm assuming that they don't have ears as such.
No. So they have essentially, and I'm afraid I'm going to use some really inaccurate terminology, and hopefully the entomologist won't get too upset. But basically, they've got two membranes located on the end of their thorax, basically right below where their chin would be. So I sort of imagine them as being located right about on my collarbones. And it's just a pair of membranes that are sort of, you can think of them sort of like eardrums. The key difference being that they are connected to each other by this bridge of tissue. And the resulting structure, these two coupled membranes, that itself actually has mechanical properties that normally, in a distance that small, we're talking 120 to 500 micrometers apart. In a distance that small, there wouldn't be any appreciable time lag in terms of sound arriving on the left and the right, which is what we use.
Yeah.
Listen for something, we hear it first on one side. And what that structure does is it increases the apparent time lag by a factor of about, depending on where we're looking, 25 to 40 based on the original model. So it really, even though sound is arriving essentially at the same time on either side, the mechanical structure, that coupling, makes it feel for the fly as though it's arrived with a significant time delay between the left and the right.
So it feels like it's almost slowing down time in that way.
That's a really good way to think of it.
If you go more deeply into your work, exactly what aspect of the hearing mechanics interests you?
Oh, so really initially we actually picked this. This project has gone a little bit off the rails in terms of our initial intent. We picked this because or my advisor and I picked this because really what we wanted was a simple mechanical system that was relatively well studied, that fit an animal relatively well, that we could introduce some asymmetry into, because what we were interested in is taking these mathematically perfect symmetrical systems and seeing what happens when we just tweak them a little bit in one direction or another. And we got really, really fascinating results from that. We saw huge improvements above the existing improvements. So on top of the 25 to 40-fold increase in time delay, we saw another 62-fold at certain angles if we just make one of the membranes about 5% larger than the other. And that would introduce this huge shift. And we ended up finding out that that's actually observed in the population. We got some flies, we measured the tympanal membrane surface areas, and we saw that there actually is an average asymmetry of about 5%. And since then, we've really started looking at really understanding this system better. We got some x-ray images of the flies due to a colleague, Dr. Jake Soha, who visits the Argonne National Labs routinely to actually x-ray other bugs for his and his lab's research. And now we're trying to understand what it really is that allows this structure to function on a mechanical level when we increase the complexity of the model, because there are specific ways in which the model fails. And we had a bunch of theories that we believed were going to pan out for us until about 2 weeks ago, when at least the initial work, I pretty conclusively demonstrated that we were completely and utterly wrong. So we're back to the drawing board right now to try and understand what's happening physically.
So do you think that this is a pervasive phenomenon? Do you think that there are more species that are showing this kind of asymmetric hearing?
That's, and this is a literature search that I keep meaning to do, but we do know it occurs in other places. For example, moths have asymmetrical antenna alignment. There is, I want to say, a species of gnat or mosquito that demonstrates it. And that's actually really our hope, that we can show that there is some universal advantage to be gained by asymmetry. And the trick is figuring out, we need to really verify that that is in fact the case here, because one of the limitations of our approach is that we took pictures of the animal from straight on, which means that, you know, maybe the camera was off by a little bit and the projected surface area we're seeing isn't actually correct. And so that's why we've sort of gone into a deep dive in terms of its physical structure, because we want to make sure that this isn't just a fiction of simulation. But it is observed in other animals. But owls, I believe the alignment of their ears is actually slightly asymmetrical. So hopefully, yeah, we'll see this kind of pattern repeated.
That's fascinating. And do you think there are technological applications for understanding the hearing system of these flies? I imagine that gaining location data that's accurate is just from sound is something that would be quite sought after by, say, intelligence agencies.
Well, actually, there have been a number of different projects, including most of which have patents filed, for developing hearing aids based off of this technology, because it's really, it is an absolutely tiny structure that provides really great acoustic sensing properties. So there's at the very least that. I mean, there are at least two labs that I can think of that have been working on just essentially designing hearing aids. Mm-hmm. But in a broader sense, really this would apply to any sort of micro-scale acoustic sensing system. And from there, the applications from an acoustic perspective are pretty much endless.
I think it's absolutely huge what you could get out of this. And is that part of it that you're interested in, or are you interested in the fundamental research?
Honestly, I'm more interested in the fundamental research. I have a really bad habit of looking for underlying rules in simple systems. And once I get to the point of actually having something that we could apply, I kind of lose interest, because that's what I'd really like to find, is some sort of general rule, some sort of general statement that we can make about the way things work.
Well, this is all science for a serious purpose, but you have a bit of a history of using science for more lighthearted reasons, namely in your article in the Journal of Superhero Science called Why Ant-Man and the Wasp Need Helmets to Breathe. So before we dig deeper into the science of that article, what made you decide to tackle the biomechanics of superheroes?
Again, that was actually something somebody had suggested to my advisor that she should do this, because she's had some past research that focuses on insect respiration. And somebody said, hey, you should write an article about Ant-Man. And she asked me if I wanted to do it. And I said, sure, it sounds fun. And really that was our initial motivation was just that it sounded like a lot of fun to write, and it would be something that would give us a chance to sort of stretch our legs, topically speaking. But really, by the end of it, I really enjoyed it because it was a chance to discuss various scientific concepts and approaches and expose people to scientific knowledge through a venue and a topical approach that, you know, is done, but we hadn't had a chance to do it. And it seemed like a really great outreach opportunity, honestly.
Definitely, yeah. A superhero movie, something you're into?
Yes and no. I'm more of a general sci-fi fan. I have watched most of the Marvel movies that have come out, but I'm not someone who, you know, can't miss them. I think I've seen a couple on video rather than in theater.
I'm not really into Marvel at all, but I feel like if I could go in with this kind of perspective of just trashing the science of it, I might be able to get into it. So I like this as an outreach opportunity. So you presented this work as well at the American Physical Society's Division of Fluid Dynamics meeting. And I like that part of the abstract read, "While some questionable physics is presented in the film and the earlier associated comic books, here we sketch out a physically realistic picture of some of the significant respiratory problems that would be encountered by humans shrinking to insect size." So I can't wait to find out, what are these problems?
Well, first and foremost, the biggest one is really that when you're shrinking down to that size, assuming that we ignore the biologically related problems of the fact that now proteins in your body and the structures that should be interacting with, among other things, oxygen molecules are no longer the right size. If we sort of just push that to the side, you're still in an environment where right now, if I'm, you know, if you're in a 6 foot or 2 meter by 2 meter box, by 2 meter, you would have a certain number of oxygen atoms around you. And yep, you'd have a certain amount of air that you can breathe. But if you just shrink down, your subjective 2 by 2 by 2 meter box now has far less available oxygen in it because your subjective box is now far, far smaller. And if we actually look at the amount of oxygen that you'd have available and the subjective density that you'd experience, it's a lot like being up near the top of, well, not even the top, but well up on Mount Everest.
Oh, weird. Okay. So we, at that point, you'd be expected to have an oxygen mask, presumably.
Yes. Yeah. Or at least acclimate for a very long time on your way up. I believe, I don't remember the number we came up with off the top of my head, but I want to say it was about 8,000 meters up is the relative atmosphere that you'd experience.
Right. So presumably you'd pass out pretty fast if you got shrunk down to ant size.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So does this mean that all the Marvel things are not scientifically accurate? Very worrying.
Well, in a sense, well, yes, though, oddly, I think the biggest, most obvious problems are the mechanics of the cars. And there's been some really amusing work done on how a car that size driving that speed would react for Ant-Man. But yeah, but there is a surprising amount that you can actually, if you squint a little bit and look at it sideways, you can justify a lot of things or relate them to existing natural phenomena. And we actually used a lot of the scenes from the various movies as evidence for how the mechanical structures or that were in the suit or how the suit mechanisms would have to function in order to produce the effects that we were seeing in the movie, especially when, for example, Ant-Man got unusually large and appeared to suffer from hypoxia and the fact that they were concerned about him drowning when he was underwater. So we used all of that to inform sort of what the design was. But yeah, I'd say Marvel is historically, though, I would say easier to justify than DC. I have sort of a grudge against DC in terms of trying to make anything that they've done work.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned that this has been good for outreach. What kind of reception have you got to the work amongst non-scientists?
So it's actually varied a lot. Some people have read the articles. I'm not sure how many people have actually read the original paper, but read the articles that were written about it. And sort of gotten really interested and talked about how this, you know, I wonder what else would apply, this would apply to, or trying to extend it to other things. And other people, I made the mistake of reading way too many internet comment sections when articles first started getting written. And the number one complaint The top two complaints were that there was a perception that I was using essentially government funding to do this work or university funding. And I really resisted the urge to go on and say, no, this kind of work, whenever you see this, this is something that people did on weekends in their spare time.
This is fun.
There's no way without funding for this.
Yeah, I suppose it's one of those things, isn't it? If you're on the outside, you don't necessarily realize that actually academics can be nerdy enough to just want to do this sort of stuff in their spare time.
Yeah, and that's actually sort of spiked my interest in trying to, not reveal, that sounds like it's clandestine and hidden, but provide a way for people to see what life in academia is actually like in terms of, like, why are conferences important? Why do people go to them? How does funding actually work? And for example, my research is all essentially unfunded. I'm just paid through teaching assistantships. So that's what I'm paid to do. And then the research is all just, I have to make my own way with that.
So what other kind of outreach work do you do?
I've given a couple of talks about this and other various topics at local breweries. I have done some volunteer work at a local science museum, specifically discussing the nature of the expansion of the universe and dark matter and dark energy at a science festival.
Very cool topics.
I think so. But I think one of the challenges to overcome is whenever you talk about topics like this, people who volunteer to do that obviously think it's cool because they're volunteering to do it and they're really engaged. And the trick is to not get lost in that and to actually try and explain it in a way that somebody who may have never heard of it or may not know why you care about it can actually get some of that out of it, not just the babbling on about something that you love and hoping that'll be enough to carry everyone else along. But mostly I've just been doing, for the moment, various science talks and bar nights, things like that, to try and do what I can while I'm finishing up my degrees.
And you're doing a dual master's, so that's two theses at the end of it?
Yes. Yes, okay. I realized at some point last year that I had unintentionally completed the course requirements for a specific math master's, and it seemed a waste not to pursue the additional thesis given that I had done the work.
Right, so I see now why you said about feeling like you often don't get the work-life balance right, because you're literally completing two masters at the same time.
Yes.
Yes. So going back to your earlier degrees, your undergrad degrees were in applied mathematics and physics and astronomy. Am I right thinking you have two undergrad degrees? Because in the British system, that's a lot. So is that standard for the US?
It depends a lot on your institution. In my case, my primary degree was physics and astronomy. And then a whole load of us in the physics department realized that if we just took a couple more courses, we could actually get a mathematics degree as well. And so in closely related fields like physics and mathematics, at most schools, it's not such a big deal. It's maybe a couple of extra courses, maybe an additional capstone project if the school has something like that. But if you're looking, if you see someone with, say, English and physics, then they've just done an absolutely absurd amount of work in comparison, because there's almost no overlap in terms of core requirements at most universities between those. So in my case, it wasn't that bad. But I did know people who, say, had physics and engineering, and that was actually much more difficult.
Okay. It's still pretty impressive that a theme of your academic life seems to be, I'll take an extra couple of courses, get another degree, you know, maybe... But hey, you seem to be using it well.
I'll admit, my family has started joking that depending on their mood, either I will be a student forever until I die, or that they've started already encouraging me to not get two doctorates if I choose to go for a PhD program, given my previous habits.
I see. So it's trying to stop the habit before it goes too far right now. You could end up with five PhDs.
Yeah. I'd rather not. It took me a while to sort of figure out what I wanted to do, and I've bounced around quite a bit, but I'm pretty happy with where I'm at right now.
Yeah, because it feels like quite a change from your undergrad subjects to modeling biological and ecological systems. So when you left school, before you went to university, what did you think you wanted to do?
So when I was in high school, I was pretty certain I wanted to be a geneticist, and then that was my real focus. And then I sort of got to my undergrad school and I realized that the things that I found really fascinating out of the sort of spread of classes I took my first semester was astronomy and the physics classes, and that really my interest in genetics was more theoretical than anything else because, yeah, it was cool, but because of, among other things, the inherent dangers in virology and the ethical issues surrounding genetic modification of really anything, that wasn't a field where, you know, I was really interested in going into it because of the limitations that are there for good reason that are in place. It wasn't sort of what I'd imagined in my head, and physics and astronomy was much more up my alley.
And then what point did you get the spark for biological modeling work?
So actually, that would probably be when I started my graduate career at Virginia Tech, because the issue was that I got my physics and astronomy and math degrees, and I realized sort of the fall of my senior year with one semester left that I couldn't imagine myself doing astronomy for the rest of my life. Because mostly I realized that even if I came up with a really great theory or a really great model to explain something that we were seeing, chances are, statistically speaking, I'd never know in my lifetime if I was right or wrong about it due to the nature of space. So that's when I started looking at more sort of grounded systems where I could get some idea if I was right or wrong. And I started looking at flocking and swarming mechanisms in birds, fish, bugs. And that's still something that I'm really, really interested in. I just haven't had sort of an opportunity to pursue it in as much detail. And that interest in biological systems in general ended up taking me here.
Right. Okay. I love how you say you didn't have time. No, doing too many degrees. okay. So you've got a few months left in your master's. Do you think a PhD is on the cards? You sort of alluded to it then. Is there something else taking your fancy?
It might be. I honestly, right now, my plans are sort of unset. My girlfriend actually is looking for a position right now as well. In museum education, sort of at the departmental director level. So what we're trying to figure out is where can we go, what can we do, where she can actually get a job in something that she enjoys, where I can also pursue something. And I'm trying not to get locked into the idea of a PhD because I have a terrible habit of just picking a plan and then going forward with it indefinitely until something actually shocks me out of it. So I'm trying to be a little bit more proactive about thinking about what I really want to do as opposed to what I assume I'll do.
Yes, of course. And bringing that back to the work-life balance aspect, it's something that so many people struggle with when you're trying to get two jobs in one place in kind of vaguely related fields. It's very tricky. Best of luck with that is all I can say. So you mentioned before that you sort of try and fail to achieve a work-life balance. What kind of things do you do outside your work other than, you know, watching superhero films and dissecting science, of course?
So these days, I don't do that much, to be honest. I really mostly just try and swim as much as I can because it really helps me with everything. Outside of that, it's pretty much down to reading, painting, and I'm trying to figure out a way to do a specific kind of abstract sculpture involving crystal growth.
Amazing. Can I hear more about that?
Sure. So basically, and there have been a couple of people who've done things like this before, and that's where I got the idea initially. But you can grow salt crystals on a variety of different substrates. And I was always really interested in growing crystals when I was a kid, but whenever I grew them, I didn't quite have the conception that the crystal that I had sitting on my table, the thing that was, you know, a thumb-sized hunk of rock, wasn't what I was going to be able to grow out of a kit. And so I've recently sort of gone back to that, and I'm looking at growing various kinds of crystals, metal salt crystals, on at least one of my ideas initially is on biological structures, so bones, pieces of wood, anything biological in nature. But that's sort of a long-term, I may expand it beyond that. I haven't really thought about it. Right now, I'm still in the experimental stage of trying to figure out what I can grow safely, how to grow it best, what will work in my small apartment kind of issues.
That's amazing. If you manage that, please upload them to Twitter so that I can have a look.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm hopefully I will. I'll get something. My goal is to have something done by the end of this month, but that was my goal last month too, so we'll see if that works out.
You've got quite a lot of other stuff on, to be fair to you. Now, if you don't mind, before you go, I have a quick fire round for you. So you're feeling suitably warmed up?
I'll give it a shot, yeah.
Let's give it a go. Okay. What did you want to be when you were young?
So when I was young, I wanted to be an astronaut.
What is something that most people probably don't know about you?
I think that'll have to be a toss-up, depending on who we're talking about, between the fact that I was homeschooled until high school, or the fact that I have dealt with a non-trivial amount of social anxiety related to communicating.
Who or what inspires you?
That's really tricky. Honestly, anyone who actually figures out what they want to do in life and pursues it. That is incredibly hard in my experience.
If you weren't doing science, what would you be doing?
Honestly, at this point, probably writing.
And what is your favorite thing about being a scientist?
My favorite thing is that a big chunk of my job is to sit around and try and be creative enough to think of things that I haven't thought of before to solve problems. That's really a big part of my day every day.
Amazing. So if people want to hear more about your work, how should they do that? You've got your Twitter account, of course. Is that one of the best ways to stay in touch with you?
That's actually, unfortunately, probably the only way. Yes.
So remind me again, what's your Twitter handle?
So my Twitter handle is I_Max, because I got it back in the early days. And I suppose I do have a website that's just maxmichaelstites.com, but that is sort of also on my to-do list to update and fix. But hopefully I'll get to that this weekend.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Max, for coming on today, especially because it's quite early your time there.
A little bit, but it's not that bad. I think there would be a sun if it weren't so gray and cloudy.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's been such a great chat.
Thanks for having me.
That was Max Michaelstites from Virginia Tech. Isn't technology amazing? I can have guests from all over the world and distance is no barrier. Again, I'd like to thank Max for chatting to me. And if any listeners in STEM would like to be in Max's position on a later show, either here in the studio or over Skype like Max, then you can find me on Twitter as well. I'm @Eleanor_Bladen and send me a DM. Please don't be shy. I would love to hear from you. And remember to tune in next Friday for another episode of Us and STEM. In the meantime, have a great week and stay curious.